What do Christians do? Not what do they believe, not what they think, but what do they do? How do you spot one, I guess would be a good way to say it. How would you spot a Christian? How would you pick one out of a crowd? What actions or behaviors in everyday life give us away? The visible, perceivable evidence that you are a Christian, that you belong to Jesus. You know what? The answer to that really depends on who you ask. If you ask the media, they will tell you that Christians are those people that blow up abortion clinics and shoot doctors. They'll tell you that we are those narrow-minded bigots who try to keep the world from teaching 10-year-olds how to use a condom. They'll tell you that we are those people who just generally get in the way of progress. If you ask the world, that is your unbelieving neighbors, they might say those Christians are those people that go to church all the time. They're always praying. They carry their Bibles wherever they go, and sometimes I've actually seen them thump them. You know, that's what your unbelieving neighbors might say. If you want to know what Christians do, the Bible is a good place to start. You know, when in doubt, read the instructions, right? One good way to learn what Christians do is to find places in the Bible where Jesus is talking only to believers and see what he tells them to do. Well, that's what we're going to do today. Here in these last few verses of John chapter 13, we come across the primary teaching of Jesus' life and ministry. He's alone with the remaining 11 disciples. Let's begin reading in chapter 13 at verse 31 to the end of the chapter. So when he had gone out, talking about Judas, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. And if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him immediately." Boy, it's a lot of glorifies. You ever realize that? It simply means to lift up, to magnify, to be lifted up to a place of importance, of supreme importance. And Jesus said, "Now is the hour. Now is the time, the Son of Man. Now that Judas has gone and the wheels are turning, now the Son of Man is going to be glorified." Little children, you know, this is the only time that Jesus is recorded as calling his people little children. John calls them that a lot in his letters. But now that it's just those last 11, "Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer," emphasis on the little while. "You shall seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I'm going, you can't come. So now I say to you," okay, there's the setup, "I'm going away, and where I'm going, you can't come. So now," at this last, you know, these last moments, this last time, "I say to you," verse 34, "a new commandment I give to you." Now, these are 11 good Jewish boys. They know what a commandment is. There are 10 official commandments and 600 and some odd other sort of sub-commandments. And when Jesus says a new commandment, they know what he's talking about. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. As I've loved you, that you also love one another. By this love, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And Simon Peter, remember, ready, fire, aim. Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Well, didn't he just say, "Where I'm going, you can't come"? But Peter, you know, it's not giving up. "Where are you going?" And Jesus answered him, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward." Peter said to him, "Well, Lord, why can't I go?" You know, sounds like a little brother. "Well, I want to go too." "I'll lay down my life for your sake." You know, bless his heart. And Jesus answered him, "Will you lay down your life for my sake?" Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you've denied me three times. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. This is sometimes called the 11th commandment. I know last week I referred to the 11th commandment as, blessed are the flexible, for they shall not be broken. That probably fits better as a beatitude. You know, the blessed are the meek, blessed are the humble, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. But this truly is the 11th commandment given by the Lord who gave the first 10. Right there in verse 34, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. In the Bible, there are 24 words translated command or commandment or some form of that word. And 9 of those are in the New Testament. Now, of those 9 words translated command or commandment, they break down into 3 categories, 3 specific meanings. One is like an order, probably the way that we most likely think of command, the way a military officer gives commands. It's a command that has an or else attached to it. You do what I say or else. That's one kind of command. Another kind of command in the New Testament is more a directive. It's instructions. There's no or else to it. You know, when Jesus said, I only do what my Father tells me to do, that's an instruction. I only do what the Father directs me to do. And then that third kind is a precept, or you might think of it as a rule to live by. It's a do as I do. You know, it's not an or else, and it's not a direction or an instruction. It's a precept. This is how I live, and this is how I want you to live. And that's what this new command is. That's the word that Jesus uses here. It's a precept to live by. I want you to do as I have done. And this new commandment is that we ought to love one another. Now, if you look carefully, you'll come to notice that this idea that God's people love one another is not really new. It goes all the way back to the Ten Commandments. And we won't turn there, but if you want to look at Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17 later on and kind of get a review of those commandments. When you put all that together, you know, don't lie, don't steal, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't covet, and all the rest of those, people who love one another won't be involved in these things. In fact, the Ten Commandments for an unbeliever are an impossible standard. And the reason that they exist is that as we try to live up to that impossible standard, we realize that we can't do it on our own, in our own strength. And ultimately, we have no choice but to cry out to the Lord, you know, help me, I can't do this. But then for the believer, for the one who's surrendered their sin and received the Spirit and given their life to God by grace through faith in Jesus Christ and what he did on the cross, those 10 commandments become the 10 promises. You shall not steal. You shall not lie. You won't commit murder. You won't covet. You won't commit adultery. Those are promises for the believer. And all of that is based on love. So this love for one another Jesus talks about, it's not a new concept, but it's presented in a new way. As a matter of fact, the word new there is often translated fresh. It's just a fresh way to look at it. It's the same commandment. It's the heart of the law, love one another, but Jesus presents it in a fresh way. Remember in Matthew 22, and the religious leaders came to Jesus and they asked him, what's the greatest commandment? It hasn't been so long since we studied that passage in Mark. And they were trying to trip him up, because if he said, thou shalt not murder, then they would say, oh, then it's okay to steal. And if he said, well, you know, don't covet, they say, oh, then it's okay to commit adultery. And they thought they had him trapped, but they said, which is the greatest commandment? And he thought for a minute and said, the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is like it. love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two. Love God and love one another. That's what Jesus said to do. But rather than spell out every detail of human relationships, he says, in effect, just love one another and the rest will work itself out. You know, if you love one another, you won't offend one another. Or if you do get offended, you'll forgive one another. And it all flows from this idea of loving one another. He took that old commandment and he didn't make a different commandment, but he took the old one and made it new, made it fresh. A new commandment I give you. But here's the important thing. Jesus didn't just say it. He did it. Remember, this is a precept. Do as I do, not just do as I say. He not only told us what to do, he showed us what it looks like. And that's when he says, love one another. He says, love one another as he loves us. Now, that's a tall order. I mean, that is a pretty clear instruction. Do as I do. You've seen me love people. I have loved you. And now I'm telling you to love one another the way I've loved you. And, you know, that's, I don't know if I can pull that off. But are we not born again people? Are we not filled with the Spirit of Jesus? Have we not died to the flesh and been made brand new? Well, of course we have. And so we can love one another as he loved us. And there's a couple of aspects to this. If you're taking notes, the first one is to love one another as he loves us means that we love one another with a love that is selfless. That's the way he loved us. With a selfless love. You know, even the most sincere human love has an element of selfishness to it. We tend to place too much importance on the feeling of love. You know, that gooey, mushy puppy dog, I love you. You know, I can hardly say it kind of a thing. And we mistake that for love. It's not to say that feelings are wrong, you know, not at all, but selfless love is not based on feelings. I remember, you know, when I first met Mary, looked down in the front row at the Clark County Fair and knew my life would never be the same. And just to look at her, I mean, look at her. And then later, you know, to talk with her. But I realize now that that wasn't love. Because what I was in love with was not her. I didn't even know her. I barely knew her name. What I was in love with, what I was excited about, was the way she made me feel. You follow me? Looking at that face, spending time with that person, being seen with her, that was huge for me, because if a gem like her would walk holding hands with a slob like me, that elevated me about 9 echelons above, you know, the rest of the slobs that I hung out with. And I said, what's she doing with him? Obviously, she was the only one smart enough to see my special qualities. No, that's not it at all. But, you know, I would have said I loved her. I wrote love letters and I love you and love me, and it was all about love. But see, that wasn't love. I was in love with the way that she made me feel. And I couldn't have been in love with her because I just didn't even know her yet. And see, that's pretty selfish. And selfishness leads to jealousy. Because when you're in love with the way someone else makes you feel, and then that feeling is threatened, then you get jealous. You get frightened and you react from that fear. Selfless love, the way that Jesus loved us, the way he tells us to love one another, is not based on feelings. It's based on a decision. You know, the very word here for love, agapao, that's a form of agape, and sometimes it's agapas, a verb, noun, and all those different suffixes. Here, it's agapao, and it means a love that is intentional. You don't accidentally fall into agapao. It's a love that's intentional. It's a love not because of the way you feel, but it's a love that is regardless of the way you feel. It's a love that is on purpose, a love that is deliberate, a love that is intentional, a love that is selfless. See, selfless love doesn't look for what it can gain. It looks for ways to give itself away. It's an undeserved gift, like grace. In fact, the word grace, charis, means gift. You know, this gift of love. It's selfless love, I think you could say, is the essence of grace. It's a love that is freely given. Not because of you deserve it or earn it or anything about you, but because the lover or the giver of the love just determines to love you. Isn't that the kind of love we have for our kids? I mean, if hopefully that's the kind of love we have in a lot of areas. But for your kids, you know, my kids can crash the car and break the rules and they can do all kinds of stuff that might grieve me because it's going to bring them harm, but they can't do anything to make me stop loving them. Well, that's what the love that the Lord calls us to is about, that agapao, selfless love. Now, as his followers were to love one another with a love that is selfless, we're also to love one another with a love that is sacrificial. I always think of that passage in Ephesians, you know, doing that wedding ceremony yesterday. I remember all the premarital counseling sessions that I went through with that couple and how we worked our way through the from Genesis and then up to Ephesians, where he tells husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her to present her spotless and without blemish. You know, he had to give himself selflessly. He had to have a sacrificial love to make that possible for his bride to be spotless and without blemish. That's kind of what he's talking about here. Love that is sacrificial. You know, they're probably another really good, in fact, there may be no better illustration of this kind of sacrificial love than the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. In fact, let's read it rather than try to remember it, because there are some interesting details here that sometimes slip between the cracks if we just try to remember the overall story. Luke 10:25. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said, well, what's written in the law? You know, what's your reading of it? You know, how do you understand it? And he answered and said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Sound familiar? And Jesus said to him, you have answered rightly. Do this, and you will live. And of course, he means eternal life. But he, that is this lawyer, wanting to justify himself, said to Jesus, well, who's my neighbor? You know, what are the rules? Who do I have to love and who do I not have to love? Because I wouldn't want to love anybody I don't have to love to buy, get my ticket, you know, to heaven. It's kind of the idea there. And Jesus tells this story in verse 30. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. That's the downhill road on the way to Jericho. And he fell among thieves who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. You know, especially in those days, that road was full of twists and turns, and there's rocks and hills, and it's so easy for some bandits, some outlaws to kind of lie in wait. And as soon as a lone traveler comes through, they jump out and here's what happened. They took everything he had, even his clothes, and left him there to die. Now, by chance, a certain priest, ooh, a priest, you know, a religious man, he came down the road, and when he saw him, he ran over to him and helped him. He passed by on the other side. He crossed the street to get away from the guy. Likewise, a Levite, you know, one of the helpers in the temple services, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. You know, he went over the other side of the road too. But a certain Samaritan, now remember, in case you've forgotten or you're not aware, the Samaritans were hated by the Jews. They were the Jewish remnant from when the Jews were taken captive, and they had intermarried with the local people. So as far as the Jews were concerned, they were half-breeds. They had a different worship. They thought that Mount Gerizim was the place instead of, you know, Jerusalem. And it was, there was this whole cultural, racial tension between the two. And so when Jesus says, but a certain Samaritan, it was, you know, you can just imagine these Jews kind of, you know, wipe their hands off just at the very thought. Ooh, yuck. As he journeyed, he came where he was, you know, found the man that had been left to die. And when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. You know, that was the best. That's like Bactine, you know. You put some oil on it, you put some wine on it, that's the best you can do. And he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. You know, he put him on his donkey and they went to the nearest Motel 6 and got a room for this guy so he could recover. And on the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper and said to him, take care of him and whatever more you spend when I come again, I'll repay you. This is the equivalent of letting the guy swipe your credit card and say, whatever the bill is, just run it up. You know, I'll take care of it. So Jesus says, which of these 3 do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And he said, and he who showed mercy on him. And Jesus said, go and do likewise. Great example of a sacrificial kind of love. Here he is with a total stranger. You know, the priest and the Levite, they cross the street to get away from the guy. They claimed to love God. I mean, they were religious professionals, but they didn't love the people. They weren't willing to sacrifice their religion or their religiosity, you know, their ceremonial purity. Now, the Samaritan guy, he sacrificed all that and more. His heart went out to the guy. That's the first thing. Compassion. His heart went out to him. Instead of having a hard heart, you know, to cross the street, he's had a soft heart and he went to the guy. He did all he could to take care of him. Pick him up, dust him off, use the oil and the wine and, you know, everything he could think of to do, get him a room, check him in, make sure he's tucked into bed, he's warm enough, he's got everything he needs before he leaves. And then he actually puts his own money down, or his credit even, you know, puts his money where his mouth is. Sacrificial love. That's a model of love in action, the kind of love Jesus is talking about. The new commandment I give you, that you love one another sacrificially. Also, to love as Jesus loved, it means that we're to love one another with a love that is understanding. And this is a difficult one to put into practice. It's easy to think about, easy to commit to, but not so easy to do. Verse 36 again, Simon says, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus said, where I'm going, you can't follow me, but you will follow me afterward, you know, speaking prophetically. And Peter said, well, Lord, why can't I follow you? I'll lay down my life for you. And I don't think the Lord doubted Peter's sincerity for 1 minute. I'm sure Peter meant what he said. I'm sure the Lord was sure that Peter meant what he said. But the Lord understood something that Peter didn't understand. You know, in the garden, Peter took out his sword. Remember that? We'll read about it in another week or two. And he's ready to die. He's ready to do what he said he'll do. Take out the sword and, you know, cut guys up. He ends up trying to cut a guy's head off, misses and takes his ear off by mistake. And Jesus picks up the ear, you know, puts it back. Wow, you know, it's like, Peter, enough already with the sword. But that's where his head was at. You know, he was ready to go and then just hours later in the high priest's courtyard, he denies that he ever even knew Jesus. And we'll get to that pretty soon too. But there's this 3-part denial. You know, you're one of them. I am not. Well, you were with them. No, I wasn't. Surely you're one of them. I don't even know what you're talking about. I mean, and then the rooster crows. From sword play and risking his life to this total denial that I don't even know what you're talking about. You know, once in a while, well, put it this way, it's always easier to die for Jesus than it is to live for him. I have this fantasy, by the way, I go to the ATM machine and I withdraw my life savings and I put the 20 in my wallet. And just as I'm walking away, I hear this, you know, stick 'em up. And rather than, take my 20, I have this fantasy that I turn around and say, go for it, buddy. You're doing me a favor here. I'm ready to go. And, you know, 20 bucks, 200 bucks, doesn't matter to me. I imagine I would shake like a leaf and wet my pants if it ever really happened. But in my head, you know, I'm a superhero. I'm Dirty Harry or something. It's so much easier to die for the Lord than it is to live for Him. See, we all make promises that we can't keep. That's what Peter's doing here, and the Lord understands that. How many times have you said, I'll never do that again? How many times today have you said, you know, how many times since you got here this morning have you said, I'll never think that again, I'll never say that again, I'll never do that again? We all do that. We all do that all day, every day. It's just part of the flesh. It's part of the human nature. And see, the Lord understands. Again, later on in this same passage, He's going to say, I know that the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That doesn't surprise Him. Oh, I can't believe I did it again. I promised I never would. Oh, I can't believe it. And the Lord says, you know, I'm not the least bit surprised. He understands. That doesn't give us permission, but it teaches us about love, to love one another with this understanding. When we let ourselves down, we get disappointed, right? Walk around in a funk, you know, turn the lights off. I can't believe I did it again. Oh, Lord, You must be so mad at me. I'm so disappointed in me. You know, we get disappointed with ourselves when we don't keep our promises to God. But you know, do you realize that Jesus is never disappointed with you? Never. He may be disappointed for you. You make a bad decision, and He knows what the consequences are going to be. Oh, I really wish you hadn't done that. Oh, man, this is going to hurt. But He's never disappointed in you. He can't be disappointed in you. He loves you. He understands you. Love that understands can't be disappointed. Love that understands can't be frustrated. Aren't you glad the Lord doesn't get frustrated with you? Boy, I am. I get frustrated with me, but He never does. You know, all the times you start over, today is the first day of the rest of my life. You know, and we get to say that every day or several times a day. We get inspired. We get motivated to transform ourselves. And then we find ourselves back in the same old habits. Anybody besides me relate to that? Lord, I'm through with those peanuts forever. There's calories in them and they're not good for my system. And when the dogs eat them, they leave the shells all over the floor and I hate vacuuming. Lord, I'm swearing off the peanuts for a variety of reasons. And you've seen me at the store, standing in line, peanuts. I'm hungry, and I like the peanuts, and I won't make justify, but my doctor told me they're better than potato chips, but because they're real food. So I take some comfort in that. But you know the idea. I'm swearing off this, or I'm never going to do that, or I'm always going to do this. And then we find ourselves right back where we started, and we get frustrated with ourselves. But the love that the Lord calls us to, the love that He loves us with, is a love that understands. He understands us. And so we are to be understanding towards one another. We're to love one another selflessly, sacrificially, with understanding, and we're to love one another with a love that is forgiving. You know the biggest difference between Peter and Judas after the crucifixion? Judas didn't understand that Jesus' love is forgiving. In fact, Judas didn't understand Jesus' love at all. Judas just didn't understand Jesus. He felt he could never go back. He felt he had no choice but to do what he did. He regretted what he did. He threw the money back and The scriptures tell us he took his own life. He was so upset with himself. Forgiveness is absolutely central to the love of the Lord. You know, John 3:16, the foremost characteristic of the relationship is forgiveness. For God so loved the world that whoever puts their trust in Jesus has their sin forgiven. That forgiveness is at the heart, at the core of the whole thing. Mercy's great. Grace is great. But without forgiveness, they're just kind of neat qualities to talk about. Forgiveness is the thing that makes the difference. God loved the world with such a love that he gave his son to make a way for forgiveness. Now, if we are ever going to begin to love one another as Jesus loves us, we will forgive one another. Remember that movie Love Story? Love means never having to say you're sorry. Well, that is sort of true, because when love is selfless and sacrificial and understanding, forgiveness is granted before the apology is even offered. You can step on somebody's toes. You can say something that, you know, maybe you didn't even mean it to, but it was perceived as rude or unkind. And you get some time to process that. And you come back next week and you go, oh, man, you know, when I said that, I didn't mean anything by it. And I'm really sorry. And the other person says, hey, you don't even have to say you're sorry. It's okay. So Christians are to love one another as Jesus loved, with a love that is selfless, sacrificial, understanding, and forgiving. And then, when we love one another this way, as Jesus loved us, it serves as a sign. You know, the sign that you followed Abraham was circumcision. The sign that you followed Moses was that you honored the Sabbath. The sign that you followed John the Baptist was that you were baptized in or baptism of repentance. The sign that you follow Jesus is your love, our love for one another. That's what he says in verse 35. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. First of all, the love that we have for one another as believers is a sign to the world. That's what he says here. I remember the first time I ever went to church as an adult, you know, when I wasn't drugged there by my mother or something. And I, you know, it's a long story, which I won't go into, but I found a church. I thought I'd check it out. I looked in the yellow pages and find one that wasn't a denomination, because I didn't like the idea of naming ourselves after what we disagree with everybody about, you know. So I found this church, and I had heard a couple guys talk about that church, and I went there, and I'm, you know, I'm a mess. I mean, I'm divorced, and I'm a drug user and a drug dealer, and my lifestyle is not healthy or happy or wise or anything even close to any of those. I was a miserable wretch. And one thing led to another, and I'm just going to check this place out. Because, you know, what I expected was a larger version of the church I grew up in, which was sit down and shut up till the guy's done yelling at you. Then you get to go have cookies and Kool-Aid. That hit home with anybody else? I think it probably does, huh? Amen, you know. And so that's kind of what I expected. I didn't know what a real church, people who knew and loved the Lord, was going to be all about. And so I went there. And you know what? I mean, I didn't know anything. They'd say, turn to John. And I didn't even, you know, what's a John? I mean, I had to get the Bible out of the pew. I couldn't find anything. They moved so fast, I just put it back, you know, and figured I'd wait it out. And I didn't know anything. But you know what I did know just from being there? I knew that those people, and there were like 600-800 people sitting around me, I knew they loved me. I knew they would love me. I knew they loved one another. I could sense it. It was palpable. It was, you know, you could cut it, the love, with a knife. It was so thick in that place. Love for one another. And there I was, a stranger with deep, dark secrets. And I'm sure that if they knew the truth about me, they'd call security and kick me out and tell me to never come back. That's not what happened. They just loved me. And, you know, without that vibe of love, if it hadn't been real there and I hadn't sensed it, I probably wouldn't have gone back. I would have went, you know, I was right about that. Church ain't going to work for me. Better do another dope deal. Just better go back to the same old life that I was into. But their love changed everything. And that's the way it's supposed to be when God's people get together. The love for one another, as well as the love for the Lord, ought to be so thick you can cut it with a knife. The media shows the world these Bible-thumping Christian terrorists. And if that's all the world sees, then that's what they're going to think the Church of Jesus Christ is all about. How would they know anything other than that? I'll never forget when we moved here, moved into the parsonage, I think it was in September, October of that year. And I had a little, one of the faucets was a little leaky, so I went down to the market here, and lo and behold, they had on a hardware aisle, which I didn't really expect. And there was, you know, washers, and so I got a package of washers, and I come up to the counter, and I didn't know anybody, and they didn't know me, and I'm, you know, paying for my washers, and the gal was kind of friendly. She goes, "Oh, you got a leaky faucet, huh?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, where do you live? You know, where, I haven't seen you around here." I said, "Oh, I'm the new pastor. I live down in the behind the church." She goes, "You're the new pastor?" I went, "Yeah." She goes, "Good luck." "Good luck? What do you mean by that?" You know? But I found out, you know, all that person knew, or their impression, I should say, of this church as it existed at that time, was that nobody could get along. And I'm not saying that was true, but that was her impression, was that no one down here could get along, and they couldn't get along because they weren't selfless and sacrificial. They were selfish. They weren't understanding. They were demanding and frustrated with one another. That's what she thought. That's what she heard. I don't know where she got her information, but that was her impression. And as I've been here this almost 5 years now, I've found out kind of the hard way that that's the impression of a lot of folks around here who aren't here. In fact, I don't see Carla today, but this is a true story. Oh, okay. Can I tell the story? Carla's first Sunday here. Comes and she worships with us, and we have our Bible study, and I'm standing back there, and she's leaving on her way out, and she stopped and shook my hand and said she enjoyed the service, or words to that effect. And I said, "Oh, where are you from?" She goes, "I'm from down in California." "Oh, where'd you go to church?" "I went to a Calvary Chapel down there." I said, "Oh, well, we're a Calvary Chapel, you know, too." "Oh, wow, really? You know, I thought that I felt at home here." And then this is what she told me. She said, "You know, I asked some people around where was a good church, and this is what they told me. Well, down in Castle Rock, there are several churches. There's a couple of churches up in Toledo. But whatever you do, don't go anywhere near that church in Toodle." Right? That's the impression that the community, I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying that's the impression that the community has had in the past about this place. See, if that's all people see, then that's what they'll believe the church is like. Not just this church, but the church in general. But see, we don't have to let that happen. Our love for one another is a sign. In fact, our love for one another is the most effective witness to this community. There's nothing else we can do more effective than that. It is the sign of Christ to the world. The love we have for one another. "By this all will know that you are my disciples." Okay, it's a sign to the world. You know, it's also a sign to other believers. A sign that it's okay to be honest and transparent with one another. A sign that it's okay to confess your failures and your struggles without being condemned. You know, our love for one another is like a welcome sign to other believers. And I've been on both sides of that sign. I've gone to places where you walk in and it's like a room full of brothers and sisters. And I don't know you and you don't know me, but we both know him and that's really all that matters. And we are tight just because of that. I've also been to places where you walk in and you go, has God ever been here? I mean, there's nothing. There's no, you know, there's people putting in their time and they don't like one another and they don't like the pastor and they don't like the church and they don't really much probably like God either. But they think they're putting in their duty so they can get their ticket to heaven, or maybe they just want to have their funeral at the church and so they're keeping their membership current or whatever. You know, it's just this silliness goes on. And just by the way, you know, that the love we have for one another is this sign to other believers that it's okay to be honest. It's okay to be transparent. It's okay to tell each other the truth. It's okay to admit that you're having struggles with things. And that is what is so important about being part of a home group, because that's where that happens. It can't happen when we're all together on Sunday morning. It just can't. It's this environment is not conducive. This isn't the right place or the right time. I mean, if you want to take a brother or sister off in the corner and, you know, talk and pray, then, you know, absolutely go for it. But I'm just saying, in the general course of things, on a Sunday morning when all the church comes together and there are visitors and new people who don't know us and people are bringing friends and family and we sing those praise songs and we open the word together and we're in fellowship, but it's at home group when you're sitting around in a circle praying for one another, singing together and sharing your lives with one another. And yeah, at first, you know, you're not going to open up your deepest, darkest secret. But after a couple of months, 6 months, maybe even a year, if you're kind of timid, you gain those people's trust and they gain your trust. And then you have that, it's safe to say, you know what? I know I'm, you know, Guy Smiley on Sunday mornings and we look like our marriage is perfect and our kids are perfect, but we are really struggling with this thing, one thing, with the family, with the marriage, with the job, with the money, whatever the case may be. And that's when the family, the people that love you, are there to help. You know, they're not there to bust you. Well, I got to tell you, I got a real, you know, I've been stealing things from work. So, oh yeah, wait right here. Call 911. You know, that's not going to happen at a home group. It's really, well, yeah, actually I started stealing things when I was a kid. I stole a piece of bubble gum in kindergarten and then I stole model cars when I was in junior high and now I'm stealing computers from the company or whatever. And, you know, and we've actually had a similar circumstance actually happen, and we were able to come alongside and undergird that individual, and they dealt with the situation at work, and they, you know, for a while it looked like they may even lose their job over it, but we prayed and we hung in there and supported them, and the Lord worked it all out. So now that guilt was off of that person's mind, and there was freedom and there was restoration and there was healing. That's what happens when God's people love one another, and that's specifically what happens when you get together in that little home group. Just one more thing about home groups. Do you realize that home groups is what the church originally was? They didn't get together in hundreds or thousands or build big buildings and have sound systems and video, you know, even if they could have. It was 8 people, 12 people, in a living room, in the backyard if the weather's nice, having a barbecue, kids screaming, crying, playing, dogs barking, running around. Hey, so what? This is a family. That's what families do. It's all about that love for one another. And when we love one another, and it's great for me as a pastor to have a visitor come here, and it's happened quite a bit, actually, as I meet them and greet them, and they're on their way out after the service, they'll go, you know, this is a neat place. There's people love each other here. And I just go, yeah, isn't it great? Yeah, there's a few, you know, there's some folks that still won't sit together. There's stuff, you know, secret stuff. But the Lord's working it out. We'll get there. You know, when you hold hands in a circle, you don't have to move down one, you know. We're getting there. We're getting there, but it's neat to have visitors, strangers, recognize the same way I recognized that first time I went into Crossroads Church, that this place is full of the love of God. And you know what? There's probably nothing I could do to make these people not love me. That's what the Lord is talking about. It's a sign to the world. It's a sign to other believers. And lastly, the love of the Lord, loving one another as the Lord loves us, is a sign to ourselves. You know, it's 1 John 3:14. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love our brothers. You know, the love of God has been poured out, shed abroad in our hearts. And even if we have no love of our own because we're hard-hearted and petty, the love of the Lord can still flow through us. And we know that we've passed from death to life. See, the love for one another, the love for brothers and sisters in the Lord, is like a gauge of your own spirituality. I know when I went to elementary school, the place was heated by a boiler, giant boiler. You could go by the custodian's room and down the basement, and there's this big boiler. And you know, if you want to know how the boiler's doing, you don't unscrew the lid and look in. You can't do that. But there was this gauge, this glass tube on the side of it. And it had, you know, a quarter full, half full, three quarters full. Had a temperature gauge to tell you how hot the thing was. Gauges on it. Our love for one another, your love for the other brothers and sisters in the fellowship, are like that gauge to tell you, not for anybody else to judge you, but for you to gauge your own spiritual maturity. Am I loving these people? Or am I still petty? Am I forgiving? Am I understanding? Am I selfish or am I selfless? Am I sacrificial? We can gauge our spiritual maturity by the way that we love for one another. Here's a test. If loving one another as Christ loves us were against the law, would you get arrested? Could you get arrested? Before we get all fired up and go out and start loving one another, let's be reminded of one very important thing. The love that we have for one another is only a reflection of God's love for us. As the depth of His love for you fills you to overflowing, you give yourself away selflessly and sacrificially, and we receive one another with understanding and forgiveness. You look to the love of the Father who selflessly sacrificed His Son. You look to the love of Jesus who, because He understands our weaknesses, went to the cross that we might receive forgiveness. You go to the well of God's love and drink deeply, because only then will the love of Jesus overflow into the lives of others.